made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sports shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handcrafts and telling their stories in North America.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. One of the foremost authorities on the assassination of Abraham Lincoln is our guest this afternoon. Michael Kaufman has been studying Lincoln and his assassination for more than 30 years. He is the author of American Brutus, John Wilkes Booth, and the Lincoln Conspiracies. Over the years, the assassination has produced an amazing number of articles and books. The government records available are impressive. For example, the Lincoln Assassination Suspects File is 11,000 pages long. All this presents historians with a daunting task, but Kaufman has been undeterred. He built a unique event-based database different from the statistical models used by most historians. In the introduction to his book, American Brutus, he says, this system has revealed, quote, new relationships between the plotters, unnoticed patterns in Booth's behavior, and a fresh significance to events he once considered unimportant. We'll talk with Michael Kaufman this afternoon about some of what he's learned about Lincoln's assassination. Listeners, I look forward to your questions for Michael Kaufman. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Michael Kaufman is a political historian. He is a graduate of the University of Virginia. He's appeared on A&E, the History Channel, C-SPAN, and the Learning Channel. In 1995, he was called to testify as an expert witness in the Booth exhumation hearings. His book, American Brutus, John Wilkes Booth, and the Lincoln Conspiracies, is published by Random House. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Michael Kaufman, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. More than 30 years spent on this history. What was it that first ignited your passion?
Well, I moved around a good deal as a military brat, and when I went from one place to another, I found myself having nothing to do, very few friends, and I decided to sit down and read a book, and that happened to be Jim Bishop's book, The Day Lincoln Was Shot. Like so many other people who got bitten by this bug, I realized very quickly that I knew an awful lot. I felt comfortable with this story. I felt almost like I owned it. And I decided, hey, this would be a great thing to write about. And being in my early teens, I thought, my ego being what it is at that age, that I was an expert. So I sat down and started writing, and the more I wrote, the more I realized I've got a lot of questions here that book didn't answer, and none of the other books did either.
Yeah. I mentioned in my introduction this event-based system of organizing information you've developed to study the assassination, and I would imagine this has generated a good deal of interest from other historians. Is that the case?
Well, I'm not so sure. I haven't heard from anybody about it. Believe it or not, I kept trying to push it on the Random House people as kind of some sort of a turning point in the way history is studied in events like this. And I got very little response from historians so far, but then again, the book hasn't been out
that long. Yeah. What has this system of looking at organizing the information, what has it allowed you to do?
Well, I really feel that that people who write books do not pay enough attention to cause and effect. And when we see so many things taken out of context, as they typically are in books on the assassination, we sort of lose sight of the fact that one thing may have actually caused another, that two things may have happened at the same time, and could not be coincidence. And so I put a lot more faith in the importance of determining which came first and which came afterward. Putting things in chronological order became almost the hallmark of what I was doing. So when I started entering different events, different pieces of information into a computer database, I made sure that I knew what time of day, or approximately what time of day, and certainly what day of the year something occurred on. And then the computer, of course, sorts these things out chronologically for you, and you find that there are a lot of surprises in there.
Mm. What was the biggest surprise for you?
Well, really the biggest surprise had less to do with chronology than the fact that that John Wilkes Booth was manipulating people in such a cold-hearted way. I say that because the Booth conspirators, the people who had been involved with him in a plot first to capture Abraham Lincoln, were really not killers. With one exception, they were the kind of people who would never have consented to join in any conspiracy that involved loss of life. And Booth just didn't level with them about his real intentions. He treated people well, let's say that he was more than willing to sacrifice them to gain what he wanted to get out of this conspiracy. And I thought that was amazing to me that so few people have picked up on this in the past.
Yeah. Your thinking about Booth changed over time, didn't it?
Well, like everyone else, when I started out, I thought of Booth as the ultimate villain. The sort of snidely whiplash character, always dressed in black with a black hat, always with the mustache. He was absolutely evil incarnate from the beginning. And then when you tried to get a handle on what kind of human being he was, because after all, we're all complex, even Hitler liked his dog, and I thought, well, there must be more to him. So I began looking at what his family and friends said about him, and they were uniformly presenting the picture of him that made it seem even more of a mystery about why he did what he did. He was apparently a very likable, friendly man without a trace of vanity. He was smart, some said even brilliant, incredibly successful as an actor, perhaps one of America's best actors, in the opinion of hundreds of critics, during the time that he was out plying his trade on the stage. So I really got more puzzled than anything else the more I learned about him.
Yeah, a lover of nature, a devoted uncle.
Oh, the pictures of him rolling around on the floor with his children, or learning sign language just because there was a young woman poet whose work he admired and he wanted to talk with her about it. He loved poetry, was almost obsessive about it, was always writing poems, and he seemed as if nothing was more important to him for a number of years than the acquisition of knowledge. These are all very positive traits, and you really can't square that with what he did until you start getting into his world, until you start trying to understand what was going on around him as the Civil War and the sectional crisis developed.
Yeah. He was a native of Maryland. He considered himself a Southerner, and he was a proponent of slavery. How did he come to his view of slavery?
Well, being born in a place where slavery was very common, he simply didn't really see it the way many other people did. Obviously, he did not think about slavery as the institution where somebody would own 1,200 people, never know their names, never really have anything to do with them. They're nameless, faceless people whose job it is to go out into rice paddies, braving the dangers of cottonmouth moccasins, and I mean, just so many things about the institution he never saw because he was almost right up at the Mason-Dixon line, where the institution itself was so different. They generally had just a few slaves in his part of the world, and one family, in fact, might live with those slaves and spend their entire lives sharing a house with them and treating them as, I hate to say family, but in essence, they exchanged Christmas presents and things like that, and it just really wasn't at all the kind of institution so many people were attacking when the sectional crisis developed in the 1850s. Booth saw it in a very different light because his world was very different from that stereotypical picture.
So he had a distorted view of slavery, and he must have also had a distorted view of Abraham Lincoln.
Well, his view was sort of very narrow. I mean, it wasn't the overall picture, and it certainly didn't look. And I think anybody who does or did at that time defend slavery really had to narrow the view and put on the blinders and forget about such things as the presumed right of people to separate parent and child, things like that that just really didn't come up in Booth's world. And when John Wilkes Booth went up to Philadelphia to apprentice as an actor, the sectional crisis really began heating up. This is the late 1850s. And he attended a number of rallies, and the general theme, even among those people who were staunchly abolitionist in Philadelphia, were saying, the people to the north of us are starting this. They are picking on the South. They are playing on their fears. They are trying to gain, for their own personal political ambitions, they are trying to gain enough strength so that they can win an election without even including the South in it. And this is what Booth heard in the North. Later on, as an actor, he went up to New York City and spent a lot of time there. And what he heard there was just as strongly anti-Lincoln, because in New York they just hated the man for a completely different set of reasons. They didn't like him up there because of the draft more than anything else. So in the South, the reasons are obvious why Lincoln was unpopular. In the North, the reasons are probably less obvious, but, to one already tuned to that sort of political ideology, he certainly would have picked up on the fact that Lincoln had a lot of enemies no matter where you went. Mm-hmm. Now, in the beginning of the war, in April 1861, Lincoln reacted to secession and to the firing on Fort Sumter by calling for troops. Those troops, by necessity, had to come from the North down to the South to put down the rebellion, and as they did, because of the way the railroads ran, they almost all had to go through Baltimore. And that's, Baltimore and Bel Air, Maryland, are the two places Booth had lived all his life. And when these troops came through Baltimore, it didn't sit very well with the local populace, and on the 19th of April, 61, there was a riot. Including much loss of life. And because of that, Abraham Lincoln and his Secretary of State, William Seward, realized that the people of Maryland, who appeared to be leaning toward the South, certainly the most noisy element was, they had the ability to block the troops from getting into the war, the Northern troops. And so they declared martial law first in Maryland, what I call the I-95 corridor. If you're familiar with the area, the route leading from Philadelphia down to Washington, covering Wilmington, Delaware, and Baltimore, was first declared under martial law, and that meant that you could arrest anybody for any reason or for no reason at all. And this was enormously controversial to the people of Maryland. Eventually, that martial law extended to the whole state. Eventually, later, to the whole United States. And this first impression that Marylanders had of Abraham Lincoln was that he'd overstepped his bounds. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court said that Lincoln couldn't do this, and Lincoln kept doing it anyway. So there were so many people in this part of the country, that is the border states, particularly Maryland, where Booth was from, that they felt that Lincoln did not regard himself as bound by the laws, and so he became an issue all by himself.
Hmm. Well, outside of these events and the political climate, maybe we could take a look now at Booth's relationships, the important relationships in his life. Can they help us better understand him?
Well, absolutely, because John Wilkes Booth had been the ninth of 10 children born to a man named Junius Brutus Booth, a man whose political leanings had always gone against the building of central authority. The crown in England, for example, had always found that the Booths and the people associated with them, such as John Wilkes, the Englishman, the member of Parliament who had been expelled from the country, had been arrested 5 times, and also elected Lord Mayor of London because he opposed the crown. These people had always been opponents of tyranny in their own eyes, and that when you go back several generations in the family, you find that they have such strong leanings in that direction that they were naming their children after the so-called Republican heroes. Junius Brutus Booth, named, of course, for the pamphleteer who had been such a thorn in the side to King George III. John Wilkes himself, named after the firebrand British man who opposed King George III. Algernon Sidney, another name in the family. So this isn't just the way they felt. This was the way they lived. This was in every pore coming out of their skin. It's hard to understand people being so completely political today, but that's the way the Booths were and had always been. Now, John Wilkes's father was also a very famous actor, perhaps one of America's best. He had come from London, where he had established a stellar reputation, came from London in the 1820s, settled into Maryland, and raised this family of 10 children. However, he already had a family back in London. A woman over there he forgot to divorce. And when she found out that he had this Maryland family, she came over and questioned all their legitimacy. And John Wilkes heard all of this, and he knew that the family, in a time where honor meant so much, this family was perhaps not deserving of the name Booth, which was a very, very well-respected name because of the father's reputation. So John Wilkes then tattooed his initials on his hand, and he decided at that point he would be an actor like his father. He would do everything to prove to the world that he was the legitimate heir of this man that he idolized so much. John Wilkes's father died when the son was 13 years old, and so he had some shoes to fill, and he and two older brothers went into acting and became the premier family of the American theater. All of this kind of leads up. You can see where it's pointing Booth in the direction that leads him directly opposite the Lincoln administration.
Yeah, yeah. And as an actor, he becomes skilled at deception, right?
Absolutely. He not only learns to, fake people out in a sense, but also he learns a lot about these plays. He has performed literally hundreds of plays over the years. An actor did not take one role and stay with it until the audiences stopped coming in. They would play a different role every night. And over a career of 7 or 8 years, John Wilkes Booth amassed a huge base of experience in a number of plays which had a lot of convoluted plots to them. If you're familiar with Shakespearean plays and the plots that go on there, you have a lot of misunderstandings and misdirection. And I think all of this helped give Booth the idea that he could mislead people and he could use the misunderstandings that were natural in human relationships to build up a group of followers who really didn't know what he was up to, and at the same time play both ends against the middle, where in this case one end was purely imaginary on his part.
Hmm. And also his fame, he put that to work also in an effort to pull people into his web.
Well, that's right. It was very important for Booth trying to amass this group of followers that he had to have people, he had to have the credibility to get people to come into his plot. And if he said, for example, we're going to wait things out, we're going to plan this over a period of time, then the question naturally arises, well, how am I going to live? I mean, I need a job. And his answer to that was, I can support you, I'm very wealthy. And he led people to believe that he had done extremely well in not only in acting, which was true, but he hadn't acted for a while. However, he had invested in the oil speculations in western Pennsylvania. Even though he never made a penny on it, he led people to believe that, in fact, he was quite rich from it. And so the fact that he was quite wealthy, could go anywhere he wanted and traveled extensively, the fact that people would do things for him because of his wealth and influence and fame was one of the major draws for people who he tried to recruit into his plot.
Quite the manipulator.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Our guest this afternoon, historian Michael Kaufman. We're talking with him about his book, American Brutus, John Wilkes Booth and the Lincoln Conspiracies. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. So what kind of people were drawn to him? Who were his followers?
Well, generally people who lean toward the South politically. That's not always the case, but most of the people who were willing to join Booth were pro-Southern, were Marylanders, and therefore anti-Lincoln. I say that because in Maryland, Lincoln's reputation was so mixed that, in fact, if you were in the northern counties or western counties, they probably loved him. In the rest of the state through which Booth would have to travel in escaping from Washington, their people could be very staunchly pro-Union, very staunchly anti-slavery. In other words, agreeing with Lincoln on almost everything, but still hating Lincoln anyway. And so basically the people Booth was able to draw into his plot were people in southern Maryland and also people who felt very strongly about the prisoner of war issue. I bring that up because I don't think books in the past have put enough emphasis on it. When Booth initiated this plot, he said the whole point of it was to force the Lincoln administration to resume an exchange of prisoners. During the war earlier on, they had exchanged POWs. If you capture some of ours, we capture some of yours, and then we swap out. Some point, because of the complications involved in the exchange of freed slaves, for example, the South wasn't going to do it. Then the North decided that they wouldn't do it, and the exchange went away. Well, this led to a lot of mass starvation and disease, huge numbers of deaths in the prison camps, especially the ones in places like Andersonville that you heard about all the time, heated up the 1864 election like no other issue did. And so when Booth realized that this was the kind of thing that the Southerners really blamed on the Northerners, that but they were taking all the heat for it, he said, you know, I think we can help the South here. I think we can force the government to exchange POWs, and all we have to do is capture Lincoln and hold him hostage. The beauty of the plan, from his point of view, was that it was perfectly legal at that time to hold hostages in time of war. And so even if they were caught, they could be held because of the martial law, but they couldn't be prosecuted under any of the normal laws at that time. So when Booth went out to gather up some of his conspirators, he appealed to their sense of humanity. He said, look, these people are actually starving to death, and if we force them to exchange the prisoners, then we're going to save a lot of lives. So it's really ironic that some people got into this for humanitarian reasons, because they had been misled by Booth into thinking this was his real purpose.
Let's talk with a listener who's called in now. Caller in Monticello, line 4. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I've read Mr. Kaufman's book and reviewed it, in fact, and think highly of it. I would be interested in hearing his a comparison of his interpretations and conclusions with those of Edward Steers in Blood on the Moon, particularly with respect to Dr. Samuel Mudd.
Well, Ed Steers, drawing very heavily on the work of James O. Hall, has said that that Dr. Mudd was guilty as a conspirator, had been plotting with Booth all along, and in fact was a key conspirator because he had introduced John Wilkes Booth to John Surratt and also to a man named Thomas Harbin, who was a Confederate courier as well. Where I disagree is with Ed is the level to which you look at the facts. What Steers has done is looked at what the prosecution said and simply repeated it. There are a couple of things that he brought up from later on, but the core of his work still is nothing more than what was already published in 1865 against Dr. Mudd. Where I differ with him in that is when you go a little bit farther, you realize that many of those charges against Mudd were answered. Many of those things that Steers says, for example, that Dr. Mudd was being deceptive because he claimed not to recognize the picture, you can find six other people in the records of the interrogations and interviews of witnesses where six other people said exactly the same thing, one of them in almost the same words, that that's not a good picture of Booth and it's hard to recognize him from it. So these little things all feed into the story that Dr. Mudd was actually guilty because he was being so deceptive. I don't think he was being deceptive. On the bigger picture, I think that when you look, as I did, at how Booth treated people, and you see this pattern of his behavior that he wanted very much to make somebody look guilty if he didn't trust them, then you can't help but put Dr. Mudd in that camp. If Mudd and Booth were co-conspirators, if they were friends, if there was anything friendly between them at all, then it really doesn't explain Booth's willingness to drop Mudd's name at every turn. Mm-hmm. Booth certainly knew that he was getting Dr. Mudd in an awful lot of trouble, and he was absolutely reckless in dropping his name. And I think that's because he did not trust Mudd, and certainly Mudd never trusted Booth.
Well, thank you. That's a very interesting. Another point or two where you differ?
Well, I just think that going a little bit farther on the record, it just shows a different picture, because if you go a little bit farther and you realize that these things have been answered, for example, in Dr. Mudd's political leanings, you can find exactly the same politics all over Southern Maryland, and it doesn't necessarily make Dr. Mudd a potential conspirator necessarily on that alone. When Dr. Mudd was in the town of Bryantown, Steers says that he was there to pick up Confederate mail. Well, that Confederate mail business had stopped weeks before the assassination. So that's simply not true. There are a lot of things in that book that he sort of gratuitously throws in. The point that he makes of Dr. Mudd being the key conspirator because of this letter of introduction Booth got to Dr. Mudd, That's, in fact, based on perjury. When a man named Eaton Horner interviewed one of the conspirators, they wrote down everything the conspirator said, and they transcribed it verbatim, and they had the man sign it and swear it out. That man's name was Sam Arnold, by the way. When Arnold was charged with conspiracy in the same case, nothing he said could be used as evidence in court, because it was regarded at that time as self-serving.
Uh-huh.
So when they wanted to bring Arnold's statement in for whatever it confessed against his own interest, which was allowed, the only way they could do that was having the man who interrogated him testify. This man was named Eaton Horner, and when Horner took the stand, he said, well, you know, Sam Arnold told me this and told me that and implicated Dr. Mudd. Ed Steers took that at face value, but I looked at the actual statement, the one that Horner was talking about, where it was transcribed verbatim, and it says nothing of the sort. Horner was one of those people who spent almost the rest of his life trying to get reward money based on the fact that he had helped implicate Dr. Mudd.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that so many of the people involved in this story were, in fact, after the money, which they couldn't get if the people they implicated were not convicted. There was a $100,000 reward put out there, and once that was in the air, once the idea of getting that much money was out there, that people started saying things that probably bent the truth a little bit, and Eaton Horner can clearly be shown as a person who said something that wasn't true, because we have the actual record on at hand. And I don't think Steers went far enough
mm-hmm.
in ferreting out the differences between the real record and what people said later about it.
Well, in my review, I said that the case could be closed, but the flow of books on the assassination won't stop.
Pardon?
I said in my review, I said that the case could be closed, you know, as it was with Posner's book on the Kennedy, but that didn't stop the flow of books on the assassination.
Oh, absolutely. There, and you know what? I'm the kind of person who I realized a long, long time ago, I am never going to have the last word. Because someday I'm going to die.
Well, I would really urge
that's the way it goes with this story. People are always going to disagree on things.
Yeah.
And I'm just throwing out what I believe based on a reading of the record. And one of the things that I did, in fact, is I put, I don't know what it is, 100 pages or so of notes in the back, just so everybody can go back and look exactly
yeah.
where I got it and see what my reasoning was and know where the disputes are and why I believe what I do.
Well, you can tell from your answers here and surely from the book that you really know a great deal about it, and I hope a lot of people will read the book. I'd only have one more quick question if there's time for it. Why did you spend 400 nights in Booth's house?
Well, I didn't start out to do that, actually. I went up there. The place reminded me of my grandfather's house where I spent my summers in Pennsylvania. And I loved it there. And the people who were owning a middle-aged couple owned it. And they said, hey, spend the night. And I did. I got a real kick out of it. And I got to learn. I got to go over to the courthouse in Bel Air and dig through the records and have sort of a base of operations right there at Tudor Hall. They were such nice people that eventually I realized I was welcome there anytime, all the time. And I started making a lot of friends in the area, and it just became a second home to me, and that's all there was to it. I wasn't really making a point of being there because it was Booth's house, but I took advantage of the fact that it was, and when people sort of made a pilgrimage there because it was, you know, this very famous place in history, I always happened to be around to start talking with them about their interest in Booth, and we helped sort of form an informal network of people who took an interest in the story. That was all very helpful to me.
Yeah. I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. I also wanted to ask you what it was like to jump to the stage of Ford's Theater. And you also mentioned that you burned down a tobacco barn, like the one in which Booth was trapped.
I want to get experience, and I want to learn something. you know, from my own mistakes, from other people's, anywhere I can get it, anywhere that I can take advantage of something and learn, I'll do it. And I happen to be shooting a video, which has not come out yet, in Ford's Theater. And we had a Shakespearean actor, and we were doing a reconstruction of the assassination. Of course, they wouldn't let anybody jump out of the box itself. But we had a 12-foot ladder there, and at some point, I was giving instructions to the actor, and as I did, I started climbing up to the top of the ladder. And at one point, I just surprised everybody and jumped off the top of the ladder onto the stage, and it wasn't what I thought it would be. First of all, I realized how out of shape I was, you know, unless round is a shape. But it was amazing to me how hard I came down on that stage, and I got a better sense of you know what Booth must have felt physically as he went down there, and I was a little bit scared. So when I just went ahead and forced myself and did it without telling anyone, I started to come down and I started to get up again. And I realized I had this sort of flow of adrenaline, this sort of rush that made me a little dizzy. And that figured into the story a little bit later on, because some of the witnesses said that Booth appeared to stagger just a second, and he set himself, and then he ran across the stage and so on. And that made perfect sense to me, because that rush of adrenaline was there for me, too. Later on, the burning down a tobacco barn, that was the same video that I was working on, and I didn't just drive around and find one and set fire to it.
Right.
I put an ad in the local paper for a tobacco barn, of which there are very few left, but a church had bought one, in fact, a whole farm, and they were going to build a new church on the spot where the barn was. And so I wanted to burn down a barn, and they wanted to get rid of a barn, and they said, let's get together. I videotaped it. We tried to recreate all that. We waited for the weather conditions to be right. We set fire to the barn about 2 o'clock in the morning using a cavalry reenactment group dressed up like the 16th New York Cavalry. What I learned a couple of things from that, too. One is that it takes an awful long time to get a barn up and going. And so I know that Booth had a lot of time to think about it while he was in there, and he saw those flames creeping slowly up the sides of the walls. I also learned that every building gets something called a flashover point, where they the intensity of the heat rises suddenly, and nobody can be anywhere near it. I was 60 feet away holding a bag of trash, a plastic bag, and suddenly my hair and my eyebrows started to singe. I had been standing there for a long time, but this was just very sudden. I dropped the bag and I ran away, and came back later and found the bag had been completely melted. And that made a part of the story make sense to me. When all the soldiers said, well, we put Booth out on the lawn, and then the intensity of the heat got suddenly grew so much more intense that we had to take him up to the house. That explains why Booth died on the porch of the house as opposed to right outside the barn that was still on fire. So, you know, little things, they don't mean that much to history, but, you know, they made the story a little bit more realistic to me, and they made it possible for me to tell it in a way that that would make sense to the real experts, the people who knew things about fires and, you know, jumping and all of that.
Let's take another call. A listener on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I have two questions about two individuals involved in the conspiracy. One you've mentioned, Dr. Mudd, and the second is Mary Surratt. Many years ago, I read a book that was based on transcripts, or a transcript for a manuscript for a witness at the trial, Louis Weichmann, who was a government clerk that lived in Mary Surratt's boarding house.
Yes.
And I've read his trial testimony as well. In the trial, he suggested that Booth and Mudd had met on Washington, D.C. street sometime earlier, months earlier than the assassination, thereby further implicating Mudd in the conspiracy. And second, of course, he implicated Mary Surratt by suggesting that they had taken a carriage ride and driven out to the tavern in Surrattsville where the carbine and the other items were left for Booth to get following the assassination. So I've long wondered, is any of that true?
Well,
did he tell the truth at the trial?
Well, I think Weichmann's story was that he knew that he was under a great deal of pressure, because if the prosecution wanted to, they could have prosecuted him as a conspirator as well. He was always in the right place at the right time when almost anything was happening. And so he was the main witness against Mary Surratt and also against Dr. Mudd. When I looked at these cases, I saw them in opposite terms. In fact, Mrs. Surratt looked guilty because of what she did. Dr. Mudd looked guilty because of what Booth did to him. And that made all the difference in the world. The meeting that Louis Weichmann talked about and that the caller mentioned was at the National Hotel, just outside the National Hotel, only a couple of days after Booth and Mudd had first met. When Mudd was there in Bryantown the time that Booth met him, he told somebody that he was going into Washington to a certain place to pick up a stove. This was right before Christmas, and he said, I wanted to get this stove and bring it back. Would you mind bringing it back on your wagon? Well, John Wilkes Booth was sitting right there, so he knew where Mudd was going to be. And when Mudd showed up at that store at that time, a couple of days later, John Wilkes Booth called out to him and said, hey, Dr. Mudd. The doctor turned around and said, oh, it's you. And they talked for a minute, and Booth said, I want you to introduce me to John Surratt. And Mudd said, John Surratt? Oh, I haven't seen him in years. And he said, well, I've got his address here in Washington. And Mudd said, I didn't even know he lived in Washington. And Booth said, yeah, here's the address. Well, just then, as if on cue, John Surratt came down the street. And Booth sort of prodded Dr. Mudd to make the introductions. Dr. Mudd said, okay, you know, this is Booth, this is John Surratt. They went up together with Weichmann, who was standing there in a federal uniform, which makes all of this make even less sense. They went up to Booth's hotel room, and at some point, Dr. Mudd asked John Surratt to come out of the room. He wanted to say something to him. What Dr. Mudd said later on was that he told Surratt, I don't really know this guy, and I don't want you to think I'm vouching for him. That makes perfect sense to me, because that's consistent with everything I've come up with. Later on, Weichmann said that they had all gone out of the room together and left him out of the conversation. Mudd said that Weichmann was being honest, but simply remembered that one little thing wrong. Mudd said, in fact, that Weichmann had sort of spun everything, but generally got it all right, which is a strange thing to say about the witness against you. But at any rate, this shows, I believe, how Booth was doing things to Mudd, getting him to come out, getting him to introduce. In fact, John Wilkes Booth already knew John Surratt, as Surratt admitted later that it wasn't Dr. Mudd who introduced him, and it wasn't on the street, and it wasn't in the winter. It was in the fall, and it was somewhere else. So this was a setup. This is something that they wanted to hold over Dr. Mudd, because he had shown a lot of suspicion toward Booth. And later on, Booth would be able to do to Mudd what he did to almost everybody else involved in this story, or potentially involved. That is, that he could say, you can't tell on me because you've been seen here with me. You've done this with me. We've gone together, we've done everything together, and you look like a conspirator. Under the law in 1865, there was no way out of this. If a prosecutor felt that he had enough legitimate evidence to put you on trial, he had a moral and legal obligation to do so, and then anything that you said could not be used in court. That was the key that made John Wilkes Booth's job easy. He was able to tell people, you look guilty, so if you want to tell on me, fine, but you're just going to tip them off, and you're going to be prosecuted with me, and nothing you say can be used in court anyway.
I'm really sorry to say we have to wrap up here. I have one last question. But Michael Kaufman, please make your answer as brief as you can. The opening paragraph of this book will get readers going right away, and you won't want to put it down. But the end of this opening paragraph says, hundreds of suspects, this is following the assassination, hundreds of suspects were rounded up on the vaguest suspicions. Some were arrested on looks alone. Of those, many were kept in isolation, bound and hooded to await a trial by military tribunal. Now, all but one of the suspects who went to trial were tried by military court. Do you see parallels from what happened then to our recent history?
The subplot of this book was that history repeats itself.
Mm.
And I started writing this on September 10th, 2001, and the events of the following day have influenced everything I wrote in here, because we do get, once again, from this earlier story, we do get a strong sense of what happens when governments react to dire emergencies, and how their reaction will affect certain individuals in ways that may not have been fair.
What a story. Well, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you.
Michael Kaufman has been our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. Look for his book, American Brutus, John Wilkes Booth and the Lincoln Conspiracies. The book is published by Random House. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here today with the numbers, Jay Pierce.
Thank you very much. Last December, wheat on the Board of Trade had a high price of 290.5 today, a low of 283.5, the settlement 284, down 6. March wheat, the high 303.25, the low 295, the settlement 296.5, down 5.5. May wheat had a high of 310, a low of 302.75, the settlement 303.5, down 4.75. July, the high today, 317. The low was 309.5. The settlement 309.75, and that was down 5.75. September 05 wheat had a high of 318, a low of 317. The settlement 317, down 5. December corn, the high today was 196.25, the low 193.25. The settlement 193.5, down 1.25. March high today, 204.5, the low 201. 201.25 was the settlement, down 1.75. May corn, 202 was the high, make that 212. 212 the high. The low was 208.75, the settlement 209, down 1.5. July, the high today, 219.5, the low was 216.25, the settlement 216.5, down 1.75. September, 226.5 for the high, 224 was the low, 224 also the settlement, down 2. And December 05 corn, the high today, 235.5, the low was 233, the settlement 233.25, down 1.75. December oats had a high of 168.5, a low of 168, the settlement 168.5, up 0.5, and March closed up 1.25. The high today 156, the low 153.5, and the settlement 154.5, and again that up 1.25. January soybeans, the high 539, the low 527, the settlement 533, up 6.5. March 538 was the high, 525 the low, 533 the settlement, up 6.5 as well. The May contract, 541 for the high. The low was 530. The settlement, 536.5, up 6.25. July soybeans had a high of 547, a low of 534.5. The settlement was 542.25, up 5.5. August, the high 547, the low 545.5. The settlement, 545.5, up 6.5. September, 549 for the high. The low is 545, the settlement 545, up 4. And November 05 soybeans had a high of 559.5, a low of 554, the settlement 554.5, up 4.25. The December soybean meal contract had a high of 161.50, a low of 157.50, 160.50 was the settlement, up 370. And the January contract had a high of 161.30, a low of 157, the settlement 159.40, up to 70. December soybean oil, the high today, 1995, the low 1970, the settlement 1990, up 23. And January soybean oil had a high of 2010, a low of 1983, the settlement 1992, up 15. And now with the settlements from the Mercantile Exchange, here's Celeste.
Thank you, Jay. Let's take a look at what happened today on the Mercantile Exchange. I think I would call it a mixed day today. On the Merc, January feeder cattle, 101.10, the high, $100.10, the low, $100.57.5, the settlement, that down 27.5. March feeders, 97.30, the high, 96.25, the low, 97.20, the settlement, that up a nickel. April, 96.05, the high, 95.10, the low, 95.75, the settlement, that down 15. December live cattle, 85.85, the high, 85 even, the low, 85.50, the settlement, that up 10. February, 86.95, the high, 86.25, the low, the settlement, 86.60, that down 10. December lean hog, 74.85, the high, 74.15, the low, 74.75, the settlement, that up 62.5. February, 72.75, the high, 71.55, the low, 71.60, the settlement, that down 7.5. April, 70.65, the high, 69.70, the low, 70.17.5, the settlement, that up 20. May, 70.35, the high, 69.75, the low, finishing at 70.20, up 52.5. And February bellies, 98.50, the high, 96.35, the low, finishing at 96.57.5, that down 70. The Dow currently down 5 points at 10,548. The NASDAQ off 1 at 2128. And the S&P 500 off a fraction at 1189.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Miriam Gilbert from Iowa City, Iowa wants to know, Dear Dr. Science, I am a great lover of classical music and have been listening to our university public radio station for over 20 years. Your segment is an unwelcome interruption in an otherwise refined program. What exactly are you trying to accomplish?
I'm trying to save you from yourself, Miriam. Like the Zen master who throws a non sequitur koan at a willing disciple, so does Dr. Science rearrange your neurons, often without your knowledge or explicit permission. One moment it's Brahms, the next, the sex life of planaria. High culture meets high tech. It's all just data, sound files, digitally recorded at 16-bit, 256 times oversampling, in one ear and out the other.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not